Could be quite heavy, but there will be lengthy dry periods, and when the sun's out, temperatures 6 to 8 Celsius. There will be another band of rain arriving in western areas during Friday, spreading to the east during Friday night. But once that's gone, high pressure moves in for the weekend, bringing most of us a dry weekend and certainly plenty of sunshine for Saturday. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. Now on BBC Radio 4, Will Adamsdale continues to read from The Telling Room. In researching the scandal behind the production of possibly the world's greatest cheese, Michael Paternitti goes back to ask the cheesemaker some more pressing questions.
Ambrosio was waiting for me on the steps of his parents' house. If I'd had any misgivings about my perceptions of him, they were instantly erased by the way he approached our reacquaintance, growling hello, clasping my hand, showing me around the house. It was beautiful inside, recently renovated. It might have graced the pages of This Old Castilian House, if such a magazine existed. The view out of the east-facing windows opened onto the vast meseta below. Ambrosio pointed to a stone pile across the way in Roa. My factory, he said. He pointed to Mont Virgo, which he described as his favorite place to go pee when he was a boy. Beautiful, he said. After a stop in the kitchen, where he searched out a stick of sausage, he said he had something he wanted to show us. I'd come with another friend, Jeff, this time to translate for me. Follow, he said. We trudged across the sloping land to his barn, the ground crunching beneath our shoes. This is where we kept the sheep. In the morning, I would come and say good morning to them, and they said good morning to me. He assumed a glum countenance. Of course, they were all sold. He led us into the empty barn, and we followed him to a small tack room at the back. In the darkness, it was hard to make out much until three metal forms appeared, glowing like spaceships. Ambrosio smiled. It was here he made the family's wine, and he wanted to check the latest batch, which was nearly ready. The grapes were very good this year, he said. Some hours later, we could only agree. Between 2000 and the end of 2002, I returned a handful of times to Guzman, in each season of the year, and each brief visit felt like stepping into a gilded text, zooming from the madness of America, 9/11, two wars abroad, to this moon-dusted Castilian world hovering out of time, a peaceful place that seemed ennobled with integrity. Each visit I made drew me more emphatically into Ambrosio's circle, sitting at the bodega with his brother, Angel, and often his father, Ambrosio Sr., and a rolling cast of friends. I was a riot to them, the Americano who bumbled my way through customs and chit-chat, asking stupid questions. I was a tadpole among bullfrogs. Back home by this time, we'd had another baby, a girl named May. Now it was double the diapers, double the wake-ups, double the joy and worry. I knew that when I went to Spain, I was living a fantasy, one in which I'd been freed from all responsibility, no logistics, no kids, no bills or recycling or flat tires. I glommed onto Ambrosio in the same manner as a barnacle takes to the hull of a boat, as a matter of survival. One could happily squander hours in Guzman's bar, as I did, albeit with much of the action transpiring over my head, given my still woeful lack of Spanish. While sometimes frustrating, it was pleasant in its way too, the not knowing exactly. When I was there, I'd often have a random flash of guilt, as I did whenever I was on the road, about how much my wife would love this. In some ways, it felt I was taking mental notes for her, so I could tell the stories later. I wanted, above all, to know more about the cheese. Over endless bottles of wine, Ambrosio told me he constantly revisited that day when Julian could not answer him when confronted with his act of betrayal, the stealing of the family business. He remembered the entire day in perfect detail, recalling buttoning his shirt, tying his shoelaces, and driving off to his cheese factory, where his trusted army of workers was already hard at work. He was their boss, the jefe, and they paid a certain deference to his legend. He greeted the girls in the front office and the boys in the warehouse, into the cheese-making room to inspect open tanks of milk, and he grabbed the cheese harp elbowing his way in to show Fidel and Jose how it was done, to refine their technique. He was also showing them how to love this cheese, and every moment was a learning moment. At lunch, on that fateful day, he checked on the sheep and then reclined for a quick siesta. And then the secretary came to him and said, "We have a problem." And he went to confront his childhood friend, his trusted business partner. "It was the only way we could afford it," Julien spluttered. When Ambrosio replayed the scene, that sound of his cough became for him the emptiness at the center of the universe. He gathered his workers then, that terrible evening, and addressed them. He didn't understand it himself, he told them, but the company was no longer his. He was leaving. Nearly everyone followed. Only one, Jose, stayed behind. But what Ambrosio's mind kept revolving back to was his own signature on the contract, the unwitting scrawl of his own name that had obliterated his dreams. He told me that it was like a death in the family, that after that day, he was in a downward spiral. He withdrew from his family, filled with shame, then fury. Creditors turned up at the door demanding payment. They came for everything he owned. He entered the years that he called his crazy nightmare brain. When people asked him, why not make another cheese? He couldn't explain how impossible such a thing would be. He'd given everything to this cheese. Here was a man who had once had a story for every day of the week and could sit and listen all day to the stories of old men in the telling room. Soon he found himself telling only one story, obsessively, how his best friend stripped him of his patrimony. In this tale, he was always the chivalric defender of the past's honor. But the story had no ending. He needed an ending. He could kill Julien. He imagined this, the perfect resolution. There would be some prolonged suffering first. Torture seemed the wrong word for this. Perhaps justice was better. In the trunk of his car, he placed a rope, a candle, and a cutting knife. He planned to justice Julien. And then he waited. But although it had been a relief to distract his mind with a murder plot, it wasn't lost on Ambrosio that he was contemplating a transgression from which there would be no recovery. He drove by the factory every day to take his poison a little at a time, as he put it. He never slowed or braked, but drove on, powered by his fury. With debts to pay, he found work driving a truck, and on long hauls through Europe, he foraged through the past in his mind, trying to find clues and incongruities that may have led to this betrayal. There was little to be found. That's what was disturbing. He completely missed the signs. What moment was it that had turned Julien? In this period, he heard rumors about the company. They were skimping on quality, buying inferior milk. The company was sold, then sold again. The reputation of the cheese waned. Ambrosio knew why. In order to make a magical cheese, you have to pour in your love and goodness. What they were making now was a soulless cheese from soulless milk. The desecration was complete. It was one thing to steal the cheese, another to ruin it. For Ambrosio, the question remained to kill or not to kill. If you listen, nature tells you everything, he was fond of saying. So it was fitting when Christmas Eve arrived and the whole family gathered in Guzman that nature spoke. After dinner, the men retired to the bodega. Someone uncorked a magnum of fine wine, given as a gift by Ambrosio's friend Manuel. They all sat in a circle, passing the puron. Then Angel, his brother, said quietly, "Why don't we check on the cheese?" He meant those remaining few tins Ambrosio had stored in the cave from the very beginning. They were like icons. Ambrosio unclasped the wooden box that held the tins of cheese. His hands trembled as he opened it. Could it ever live up after all these years? And why ask it to? It was best to remember it in its heyday. He stalled. "Puta madre," his father burst out. "Let's go, open it before I die." Ambrosio opened it, and with the tip of his pocket knife, he withdrew the wedge of cheese, cleaning it with a paper napkin. He cut away the rind. He parceled pieces out to the others. They were all amazed. It was perfect. Later, in the months and years to come, they would talk about this night as a kind of miracle. Another story they told, this time about the cheese coming back despite Julian's betrayal from the dead. Ambrosio had been waiting for a sign. Gazing upon his cheese, he was flooded with wonder. When it came time for the last morsel, Ambrosio held the cheese up to the flicker of candlelight like a communion wafer and listened for the wisdom of ages to speak. To kill or not to kill. Get that son of a bitch, said the cheese. I was back home in Portland with my wife, and she was in bed, febrile with fatigue, cuddled around her book. Been thinking about Ambrosio and Guzman, I said, settling next to her with a bowl of popcorn, munching. She nestled deeper into the bed. What would you say to moving? I continued, moving to Spain. Ambrosio says there's a place we could rent in the village. Sarah lifted her head, sighing, and I had a sinking sense that I was yet one more child in her life. The kids are so small, she said. Not to mention we didn't speak the language, we'd be miles from medical help, let alone supermarkets or Starbucks. We'd most likely be living in a dark hovel in a village full of mostly elderly people and a bunch of half-feral dogs. It would only be for a while, I said. Like, how long, she said. So began the negotiation. We could find more time, I said. Time for family, time for conversation, time to eat. I knew the adventurer in her had been stirred. And when she retreated back to her book that night, she said, we'd have a lot to work out, but I'm not opposed. I went to my editor and told her I wanted to write a book about a piece of cheese. She was mystified. I wrote a book proposal about taking my family there to tell Ambrosio's story. When I heard the book had been accepted, I couldn't quite process the news. The advance gave us money to make the move to Guzman. When we flew into Madrid sometime later, it occurred to me that we'd done it. Exactly as I dreamed it, back among the sunflowers, we'd reached max speed and broken free of our American life. But why? So that I could be closer to a man who I half knew, with the hope that I still might come face to face with a famous cheese? Or so I could restore that man to power and reunite him with his destiny? The answer to both questions seemed to be yes. We took a private language school in Salamanca, a 6-week intensive course teeming with foreigners like ourselves. From there, we drove to Guzman. To my great relief, when our family arrived that first time in the spring of 2003, my wife leaned forward, gazed up at the village, and uttered one word, whoa. When she met Ambrosio, he bear-hugged her, singing her name in his rumbling baritone, and she was smitten, as were the children. Everything you said about this place is true, Sarah said. We moved into a house on Calle Francisco Franco, on a hill of olive trees, surveying all of creation below. There was no TV, no house projects, fickle cell phone coverage. Without all these distractions, we quickly became reacquainted with each other, taking long walks, lingering over meals, delighting in little things our kids did. May's first step, Leo's first loose tooth. If it was a fool's errand to chase Ambrosio and his cheese, so be it. I was here to suffer the consequences.
Will Adamsdale was reading from The Telling Room by Michael Paternity. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn and produced by Clive Brill. It's a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. The shipping forecast is next, but first to take us there, it's Sailing By. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 9th of January. There are warnings of gales in German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Seoul, Lundy and Fastnet. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Seoul 1001, expected Denmark 984 by 1800 Thursday. Low 100 miles north of Fair Isle 989, expected just north of Viking 990 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra, 40s, Cromarty, 4th. Southwesterly 5 or 6, becoming variable 4, then northwesterly 5 to 7. Showers, good, occasionally moderate. Tyne, Dogger, Fisher.